This episode is sponsored by United Refrigeration and Westermeyer Industries, revolutionizing your HVACR experience. Visit URI.com for all your HVACR needs, offering real-time inventory, personalized pricing, and a nearby stock feature. Access quick pick replacement parts and branch details effortlessly. With 350-plus fully stocked locations across North America, our knowledgeable staff are ready to assist with the solutions you need. Exclusive offer. Use code ARPOD on URI.com to get a $10 gift card when purchasing the Westermeyer Oil Float, part number W4300-38F. These high-performance floats are not just compatible with their own oil separators, but also available as a crossover model. Conveniently stocked at United Refrigeration. That's code ARPOD to claim your $10 gift card. Visit URI.com now.
The Sporland Division of Parker Hannifin Corporation is sporting this podcast. Sporland is the leading manufacturer of HVAC and R components. Using quality materials and craftsmanship, Sporland maintains a commitment to innovation, manufacturing excellence, service, and support for its customers since 1934. The company is known for its catch-all filter dryers, thermostatic expansion valves, solenoid valves, pressure regulating valves, suction filters, electric valves, controllers, supermarket monitoring solutions, chemicals, smart service tools, ZoomLock Max Press to Connect, and ZoomLock Push to Connect refrigerant fittings. If folks want to learn more, what do they do?
You can go to sporland.com.
I guess that's Jim and John for Sporland signing off.
What am I doing? Can't even use this right in the morning.
I don't like this one.
I don't like it either. It's fancy. It's all digital and such, and there's just too many set points. Good morning, everybody. We are live from AHR. We're recording this early in the morning because there's lots of people going around. I think the final count, I think there was like 50,000 people here in Chicago. And man, when they're rolling around, you can't even hear yourself freaking think. So Kevin and I want to hop on real quick before this is the last day of AHR. We're going to actually be able to roll around and kind of see what's going on here today. But man, how's your week been? Like, as far as being here?
Chaotic. Monday night really sucked when I blew a tire on the way home on the highway.
Yeah, I almost died getting out of your truck.
Yeah, it really, really sucked. And then I went to go change a tire and the lug wrench exploded.
So, oh, that's why you couldn't change it?
Yeah, so I sat there for 2 hours till I finally got a hold of somebody to bring me a socket. Then two more of those sockets exploded trying to get it off because the lugs were so tight. I have some like crappy rims on there that I bought the truck, but
did you put them on with the Ugga Dugga?
No, like I've only had that truck for a couple months and I never took the back tires off. So yeah, that was a treat. So yeah, then I drove here on Tuesday through an ice storm in my Jeep, which is not made to drive on the street.
Yeah. Was that the night you got the ticket?
No, I got the ticket in my truck on Lakeshore Drive, which pissed me off because you can't drive a truck on Lakeshore Drive. But yeah, whatever. It's so far, it's been pretty cool here. It's a little overwhelming. Lots of walking. There's just a ton of people. It's cool seeing all the people that you know over here and then making lots of contacts.
Yeah. By the end of the night, I'm just like, last night, I was done peopling. I had enough people. And I was just like, because people want to talk to you about stuff. We were doing a lot of live streams, whatever. And by the end of the day, I'm just like, I'm done. I'm just physically and emotionally just done. But hey, this morning we were going to talk about the continuation of what we were talking about the other day. Why is CO2 suction killing and crashing the rack? We got into some of the things like what's happening with the bypass gas valve and the HPV and like some of that fan cycling stuff. We want to continue on that, but we're hoofing on somebody else's computer. I want to bring up some other things that'll really kind of help that conversation keep rolling. So this morning we were going to talk about CO2 basically killing the suction, whether it be low load or whatever, because a lot of times if you have that low load, you're not going to separate that oil and just a whole bunch of just catastrophe. So you want to get in? You were the one who brought it up, man.
So what I want to start with this, guys, is it doesn't matter whose manufacturer it is, guys. It seems they all have the same base problems. Okay. So first and foremost, all these compressors that they're using for the leads, they're all choosing massive compressors, which is probably one of the worst things you could do because it's not covering the gamut. It's hitting the high end, but we're designing racks for 120, 110 degree outside air for them to run for 3 days at the worst possible conditions that they're never going to see. And then the rest of the year, they run like complete shit because of this.
Okay. So I agree with you, but then there's a little bit of me disagrees with you because it's basically where you're at. So settings and rack load that they might do in Texas, if it's the same thing, if it's just a drop down, would probably be good. But like somewhere out in Chicago or somewhere where it doesn't stay hot,
but
90% of the time.
Some right? of these rack manufacturers are making a rack that they are just throwing
everywhere
from Texas to Chicago.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Same setup, same everything. That doesn't work.
I agree.
That's part of the problem, but a lot of the problem with this can be tuned out. Now, going through this, guys, this low load situation. Okay, so we went over with the flash tank, how to, you know, falsely create the load on the flash tank by lowering the subcooling or raising the minimum flash tank pressure up. We went over that. Now, there's a second caveat to this is the actual like suction control. Okay, so a lot of these stores are set up with case controllers. Now, these case controllers are controlling superheat and temp. Okay, 90% of the time, they're controlling temp and not superheat because a lot of these racks have their suction ran down low, a plus 18, a plus 16. I see it all the time on Legends, plus 15. Okay, nothing on that rack requires that. So on that rack, you may have cases that require a plus 27. Okay, when you're running a plus 27 case with a plus 18 rack, I mean, you have a 10 degree difference from your suction saturation to what it calls for. Pause it for a second. Dude, it's kids.
We're back. So you were talking about suction control on the the difference between the lowest SST, what the rack is set for, and basically what the
yes. Okay, so guys, we're running like a plus 33 usually in a flash tank. So we got to have some difference on there, but we don't need to run a plus 18 suction temp with a plus 27 degree case temp.
But so let's start off by saying, like, some customers are like, hey, that's the way we want it. How do you go about trying to convince them that really might not be like what you're really looking for?
So either you have to convince them with data and say, okay, we ran it like this for 12 hours. Look how the rack ran.
Okay.
We raised the SST up for 12 hours. Look how the rack ran and look how much better it is.
One of the things you're going to say about floating up the suction, you still need that 75 to 100 pounds of differential between your oil reservoir. Like typically, if you have a I don't know, I guess you would call it a low pressure oil system. Because if it's a high pressure oil system, it'd go right from the separator right out to the oil level controls, the OMCs and such. And that's with floating the suction, no harm, no foul. Like you're straight there. The problem that what happens with floating the suction when you have a quote unquote low pressure system. The system is going to be the oil reservoir is going to be essentially the same pressure as your flash tank. If you start floating the suction, you get that closer to what the flash tank is, right? If you don't have that 75 to 100 pound differential in order to, you know, push that oil out, you could potentially start seeing that oil not filling up fast enough in order to do that. So we were going to talk, I think that's where you're going, right? Where you wanted to talk about if you're floating up the suction, you essentially can float up your flash tank pressure, so to speak.
Yes. Okay. So now, mind you, we need anywhere. So once you start getting below 50 pounds is when you start getting oil issues ish.
Like, stupid guy.
So as you start letting that suction float up, you're going to lose your oil differential. This is where it comes up. You just need to know where to take it. Okay. So yeah, say if you're running a 400-pound suction set point and you're running a 500-pound flash tank set point, that's a 100-pound diff on your oil, okay? Mm-hmm. That's golden. Say if you raise that suction set point up to 450, okay? Now, you raise that suction up to 450, okay? Now, you have a 50-pound differential, okay? You're still in that range where you're good. So floating up 50 PSI is a lot. That may bring you up to 420, or I'm sorry, up to 18, plus 18, plus 22-ish racks at point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is going to help dramatically, and you're still going to have that oil differential, and you're still going to be fine. Now, if you want to get more aggressive with it than that, you can, because here's the deal. So what you can do when it comes to this is you can falsely tell the high pressure, I'm sorry, the flash tank to raise its set point. Now, on the 326, it's pretty easy. All it's doing is, instead of using the main switch to shut it off, you could use it to change the flash tank pressure. So you could shift your flash tank pressure to 520 pounds. Okay. When you shift that flash tank pressure to 520, that raises your diff. That raises your oil diff. And that allows you to float the pressure more. So now you have more floating, and you keep your pressure differential on your circuits. So instead of running, say, a plus 33 degree flash tank, you may be running a plus 35 or a plus 37 flash tank. And that's the wrong PT chart.
Yeah, I was looking for a CO2 pressure chart, and then he's looking at the numbers and it says 135. I'm like, how'd that happen? Sorry, my bad. I couldn't see it from where I'm.
I was like, whoa, that is what? I'm looking at plus 33 and I'm like, that ain't right.
And why is it like 35 pounds, 40 pounds?
Yeah. As you do this, guys, you could easily raise the flash tank pressure. Microthermal, it's a writable point. So you could write it from a block logic. And then on the iPro, I believe it's also a writable point. So you could use it on the iPro to float the actual flash tank pressure up. Now, this is the benefit behind it, because when you're in a low load situation,
Sorry, I stopped because I wanted to make sure I had the right PT chart this time.
So when you're in a
low Celsius, what the hell? All right, never mind.
You were really bad in 1,000 at this one.
It's not my computer. And
So when you're in a low load situation, guys, raising that suction pressure is going to do a couple things here. Okay, so it's going to allow the cases to start controlling superheat, not temp.
Because
all of these cases are controlling temp and not superheat. And what you want to do is, when you're running a delta way off of what these cases are designed for, they're slamming down and just opening that valve a little bit. So you may be open 2, 3%, 10%. You get that SST up and you're running close to what design is. Now those cases are running 30, 40% open. The superheat's good. The load is more constant. You're not shutting everything down off of discharge air temp. That is a huge thing. Like, you look at all these cases, they're running way below set point because on the SST, because we're running way lower. And that's because of a couple of reasons. These rack manufacturers are trying to, okay, we got to hit a plus 33 flash tank pressure. We need this pressure differential.
So plus 33, now that I actually have the right one up. Dude, I'm going to blame it all on Bing is a piece of crap. If I use Google, usually I'm straight. So
yeah, plus 33 is roughly about like
495 to 500 pounds around there.
So you're running a plus 33, and say you're running what's a 400-pound suction?
400-pound suction, it's about 19 degrees saturated.
Yeah, so most of these rack manufacturers, I see the 395 all the time, which is plus 18, but you got some walk-in coils. You got to remember how efficient CO2 is and everything else. You have some walk-in coils. You maybe need to run a plus 25 on. You need to be floating off that lowest SST. And the other thing with the floating is it just keeps everything more constant, keeps everything more open, and keeps everything running. So that stops the load issue with a lot of this, because instead of like everything being slammed down and just coming down a little bit for temperature control, oh, yeah, this temp graph looks great. Yeah, it's a solid graph, but the rack doesn't look great.
No, the EV's sitting there at like 2%. And that, like, I've seen some Hill Phoenix racks where they'll have, it was the liquid pump overfeed rack where I had, it was regular cascade, but also liquid pump overfeed. But what they did was on the compressor side, on the actual part where they have the suction of the compressors at 200 pounds using actual CO2 compressors, they had everything set for minus 22 on the suction, but they actually, it was really a good idea where they had the frozen food cases actually on the whole nether line set. And then what they were doing is they were maintaining that suction with an actual EPR.
Correct.
And then that way those cases stay loaded. So they weren't cutting in and out, and then that's going to affect your suction. And if you do that constantly, what's going to happen? You're going to take out compressors because you're going to start cycling that thing off or on, or you'll see, I'm sure you guys out there have seen the VFD go just up and down, and then sometimes even have to shut off.
So with that VFD not being, it's all over the place, that affects the flash tank, that affects the gas cooler, that affects everything. That's why we're saying that this has to be looked at differently than all these manufacturers are doing, because everybody's saying, oh, we can't float because the pressure differential on the oil. It's 100% doable. You don't need a 100-pound drop on the suction to the oil. Like it's not needed.
So one quick question, because we talked about this last time, as far as if you want to put a secondary set point in, essentially you're using the heat reclaim input.
No, not the heat reclaim input. So heat reclaim input on a 326 is 0 to 10. All right, what you have to do is the main switch, which a lot of these manufacturers are using the main switch to the phase loss monitor to shut the valves down.
So that was my question. So what do you do in that instance?
You don't need it.
Oh yeah, because the only one you really need to shut down, right, would be the
high pressure valve.
Would be the high pressure
valve. But think about it like this. Okay, what's going to happen as soon as the rack shuts down?
HPV should theoretically close down. Yeah,
because a lot of these manufacturers are running a slow PID, and it's all over the place. If you run a fast reacting PID, that valve closes instantly.
Really? Yeah, but still, if the 326 is then also closing the HPV, you still need that input to tell that thing to shut the hell down.
But you don't, because it's closing the HPV off of flash tank pressure. As soon as that flash tank pressure comes above that threshold, if you have that threshold low enough, it's going to instantly close.
I'm talking about like a power outage.
Yeah, it's going to instantly close.
Okay.
Because think about it. Like, if you lose power, like, you're driving the valve shut anyway, but the HP, it's still looking at the receiver pressure. It's going to instantly close.
Okay. All right.
And then here's the other caveat to that. Okay. So that's only an issue on the mag driver.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anybody, like, which a lot of people aren't using the mag driver anymore. They're using, say, a TCMT valve, and they're using a separate Danfoss stepper. That has another inputs to it, that's not a problem.
You were talking the other day too, and I know a lot of some other, when I was up to SEPTEC, they told me a lot of manufacturers now are just putting an actual shutoff valve right before. They don't have to do the whole battery backup thing. Basically, it'll have a shutdown where if it doesn't have power, it just shuts down the valve, which closes the power, and because the HPV would technically be open, essentially that would happen.
Yeah, that whole main switch thing is, I don't think you really need it. Like on a 326, because if you have a fast enough reacting PID, it's going to shut down instantly. And you have the high fence set low enough for the flash tank, it's going to shut down instantly. And then also, with that being said, if you use the iProbe, you don't have to worry about it. It's got a separate input. Okay. If you use microthermal, you don't got to worry about it because it has a writable point for you to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry. What is that noise?
I thought it was a vacuum.
Oh,
someone's back. Oh, it's the little carts.
Oh, this is a little mini midget carts.
Yep, that one right there.
So
it was quiet this morning.
Yeah. So that's why you don't need that main switch. Yeah. And I think using that for the heat reclaim or for the raise the flash tank pressure up is a way better use of that. And to be able to float that suction. Now, you only get into that when you're floating real high. If you want to float to plus 22 to plus 24, you could easily do that without affecting the flash tank. And most of the flash tank set points, like, I run mine at like
cherry picker.
No, yeah. So I run my flash tanks at 515 usually, pretty much all of them. Like, I don't like a 500-pound set point. It's too low. I run at 515. So running at 515 gives you a little bit more room for the float. Like, I'll float to a plus 22 to a plus 25, especially at an Aldi. You can float to a plus 25 all day long because your lowest SST is going to be the dairy cooler, which is like a, they say it's like a plus 25. So you have a plus 25 and you have cases that are running a plus 28 and you got a rack that's running a plus 18.
All right. Well, and let's not talk about that right now. But let's talk about another customer where they, you know, typically have a meat box that has a plus 18.
Okay. So, but how many times have you seen that meat box with it satisfied and it's running off temp?
Understood.
Yep.
Understood. I'm just saying, like, because if we go off of that and that just that box would have to maintain, and like, you could a little bit, you could maybe bump these for some odd reason. The manufacturers are like 8 to 10 degrees for superheat for these medium temp. And like,
I
understand. Yeah. I don't agree with it because the manufacturer will tell you, the manufacturer of the case will be like, oh, 6 to 8.
Yep.
But the problem is if you're running that high, it's giving you to run even a higher PD than what the 10 that what's essentially what it's called for.
It's even more frustrating when the manufacturer of the case made the rack and the rack is saying no, but then the case is saying yes.
The problem is that they're scared that if someone,
not even that. It's, I don't think they could tune it out of the box. I've seen the set points. I don't think that the cases are not tuned properly and they're not set up properly.
Give the contractors more time. Yes. Give the contractors more time.
Like, that's why like tuning needs to be done after the food is in.
I agree.
Yep. There needs to be part of, and it's not a one tune fits all. That's what a lot of these people think. It's a one tune fits all. Okay. We use this tune over here. Well, guess what? The tune that works in Dallas, Texas is not going to work in Chicago when it's minus 10 out, no humidity, and it's 90% humidity in Texas, mm-hmm. and it's 90 degrees. That tune's not going to work across the board. It's just not, because
in a lab it does.
In a lab it does, but like that's why these need to be field tuned. Yeah, you can get like a profile set up and get some pretty good settings, but like that's why we're forced to run high suction superheats on these cases, because they're playing devil's advocate and we'll just raise them up and let them control temp. And then we won't have to worry about any superheats or tuning because we have such a high differential. Now, raising that up is a great thing. We've done it in the past on the cases. So say we have like a meat box that needs a plus 18 or plus 20. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll take the cases and put them on EEPRs. Mm-hmm. And we'll run that loop at plus 28. And we'll run that loop at plus 28. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we'll run that loop like that and let those cases all control temp. Those cases now are more steady. We have better liquid regulation. We have better superheat control. We have better all-around control because those cases are staying steady now and they're not hunting. So those valves are staying steady. We don't have to worry about that. And at the same time, we have constant load coming back to that compressor because we're running more open now. And everything's running smoother.
No, I agree. Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, it's hard to say that it's going to work because it's not. There's always all these little inferences, right? You might not be able to float this up any higher because of this lower SST. But then that's what I was trying to get to before, yeah. And then I got sidetracked real quick.
Now, think about it like this. Like, I've been seeing a lot of customers take the meat box and throw it on low temp.
Oh, either you can do that. But the other thing I was going to say is instead of having it that high of a superheat, go a little bit lower.
Yeah,
like, go a little bit lower than all the rest of them. Like, if you want to keep your other ones 8 to 10, not that I agree with that, but if you want to keep it up there because you're afraid of taking out the compressor because of low superheat, lower the other one to 4 to 6 degrees, and then you'll get a lower TD, which means you'll be able to float higher, which means you're going to save more energy anyway.
I see a lot of problems with the meat boxes too, with they're using the low profile coils, and if you don't flood those, if you don't have like low superheat, like
3 to 5,
yeah, and like they're running like 10 to 12 on them,
so now
and they ice up.
Yeah, well, I can actually show this. Anytime I talk about this, I'm doing this whole thing with my hand, and you guys can't see this typically. Now that we started doing more video, but so if you have a distributor that has 5 distributor tubes, they don't put them down at the bottom, they actually put them on the side on a lot of these manufacturers just for the sake of room. So if you're running a six to eight degrees of superheat, and the manufacturer Heatcraft wants it at 3 to 5. These top bundles aren't going to get any liquid refrigerant. These bottom bundles will. So essentially what will happen is these ones are essentially usually attached to the evaporator on the other side that doesn't ice up because they're running at such a high superheat that the manufacturer will tell you they require a 3 to 5. Like Heatcraft will straight up tell you, yeah, that needs to be essentially flooded. So what happens is where these top bundles are, they're not getting juice. They're not getting any go juice. So basically on the other side, that's why you won't have frosting on the one side. And then on the evaporator side, that where the expansion valve actually enters, you will actually get just straight up frost on there because only half of the coil is working at that point. and it just kills it. It kills the efficiency of the coil and then causes excessive defrost issues. And we've all seen it. Every single one of us. Listen, I guarantee on the one side, you'll see not a drop of ice, a drop of frost on the one side. On the other side, you will. But the saying that you could lower that superheat, one, to get the efficiency out of it, and two, to get a little bit lower of a TD, so you can, you're able to float that suction a little bit higher.
Correct. And in with how efficient CO2 is in some of these new coils, you can make it. You could get, and then a lot of these customers, you don't need to run a plus 28 meat box. Like every time I see a plus 28 meat box, I'm like, oh, I already know this is probably going to get raised up, or there's going to be constant complaints about freezing product.
I don't know. I've never gotten those.
Every time up here, I usually run meat boxes at 32.
Oh, well, once again, Texas.
Yeah, I don't see any point in running a meat box at 28 degrees.
Texas.
I just don't, because every time they're complaining, oh, the hamburger's freezing, or they stack product a little high. Like, I don't see the point in running a meat box at plus 28. I just don't. It's a complete waste of energy, and I just don't. Like, up here, like the meat guys just freak out. Maybe 30 at the lowest.
Yeah.
But that's a huge, that allows you to float a little higher and get a little more efficiency out here. Now let's go talk about the suction control side of this, where we're talking about floating, guys. So the other caveat to this is I see this all the time. I see the variable speed setup, and I see increase and decrease rates of 5,000.
That's not fast enough.
It blows my mind. And they wonder
isn't
why
5,000 like seconds.
Yeah, like it just hunts all over the place.
Today's episode is sponsored by the RefRush Shield RDP series differential pressure monitors from Westermeyer Industries, now available for transcritical CO2 systems in addition to other common pressures and refrigerants. When the filter element of your coalescing oil separator is contaminated, it can hurt your system's performance and efficiency. But how do you know when it's time to replace that filter? Wait too long to replace, and you could end up with a nasty filter blowout. But replacing too often can be a waste of time and money. The answer is installing a differential pressure monitor. The RDP series differential pressure monitors, including the new transcritical CO2 model, are available now from Westermeyer Industries. To find out more information, email sales@westermeyerin.com. That's WESTERMEYERIN.com.
Now, this is my go-to number to start with. So I will start with 300 to 400 RPM increase and a 550 decrease. I always make the decrease 150 to 200 RPMs higher than the increase. I want it to ramp up slower.
I can't believe you're actually giving away what I'm
giving away starting
He's
numbers.
So proprietary and such. I'm not giving that away.
You can't give away all the secrets of the sauce. So now I always slow this down. Anybody that's running a 5,000 ramp RPM, I can look at your suction control and be like, that looks like crap. Now, I will slow that down. I want it to slowly ramp up. I don't want it to overshoot, because what happens is with a 5,000 ramp up, ramp down, the drive's going up, down, up, down, up, down, and it just looks like crap, okay? The other thing is, it doesn't matter what compressors I have, I never have compressors that are the same size in the controller. So even if I have 525 horsepower compressors,
mm-hmm.
they're always a different size.
Gotcha.
I may go a 25, a 26, a 27, 28. I always make them different sizes, because what happens in the algorithm is it tries to, if they're all the same size, it tries to equalize the runtime. And then it doesn't matter what controller you have, it ends up messing it up. So always make them different sizes. And then here's the other thing. I always make the VFD the smallest compressor. Doesn't matter if it's the biggest, I always make it the smallest in the controller. So that way, that controller wants to run that drive compressor, because even at 50%, I don't want a fixed speed compressor coming on and taking over for it. I just don't, because it's going to run like crap.
Wait a minute. So if you don't put it for the exact size that it is?
No. Nope. Especially really? In microthermal, you really got to play with the sizing, because we just had this at another job.
It'll drop out the VFD compressor.
We just had this where it was dropping out the VFD compressor, because there was a 25, a 25, and a 15. We were low load, and it was grabbing the 15, and it would run like shit because it was undershooting. The drive could cover it. Yeah, it was running like crap with the drive too, but like,
was it the cell and decel rate that was causing havoc with it?
No, it was just the way it was choosing what compressor it wanted to run based on the load.
Okay.
So I do the same thing with Hopland stuff on the E2 or E3. like I'm always making the drive compressor the smallest, and then that way it's choosing to run that. It's not messing with the algorithm, and I don't make any compressor the same size. It may be off by 1 horsepower, but at least it's got a full set of numbers to work with, and bigger numbers work better.
Yeah, using the CFM, the actual suction CFM.
Or even BTUs, same thing. Yeah. A bigger number works better than, say, like 10 for a horsepower.
Horsepower.
Yeah, they use like 10,000, if it's 10,000 BTUs, for example, make it 10,000 BTUs instead of like 10 horsepower.
So what is that?
I don't know. Like, I'm terrible at that.
120,000 BTUs, yeah. Sorry.
So but using bigger numbers is better in the controller algorithm. But the speed up and speed down for the compressor side is huge. I see this all the time on stores where like they have a 5,000 ramp up, ramp down, and all you're doing is creating hunting.
That's really slow.
Or what?
Wait, no, 5,000? No, I'm sorry.
It's RPMs.
So. Oh, I was thinking, yeah. I'm sorry. I was thinking a cell and D cell, no. Like in the actual drive.
That would just stall out. But like, but that's your signal going to the drive. I'm so sorry. That's why it's all messed up like that. Okay. Yeah. And then making sure you don't have a suction set point that's down the ditch. Like you're running like a plus 18 and nothing needs it. Like get these raised up and you would be surprised at how this rack just transforms.
There's a friend of mine I'd really like for you to talk to then, because I've had that argument multiple times. The store just doesn't work right because the one evaporator or the one heat exchanger is at plus 18 and all the rest of the cases are plus 28. So he's only running like essentially 94% of the expansion valves are essentially shut down at that point because the suction's in the ditch.
I see cascades with that all the time. That's a huge problem on cascade racks where the primary refrigerant still going down in the store for everything else. And they're running like a plus 13, 14 degree SST on the primary refrigerant. They're all shutting
all
down.
The cases are satisfied.
Yeah. You have really shit liquid flow. You get rivering, you get crap liquid flow. And then the heat, the CO2 side of it has all kinds of problems because it starts getting rivering and then those valves hunt and then the suction's all over the place and the primary refrigerant.
And then the receiver gets high discharge pressure alarms. Yes.
It is 100% the way that it's controlled. And that particular customer is one where you see D cell and the cell rates at 5,000.
So I didn't have the epiphany for the fix until I was on the airplane. I was down somewhere and I was ready to jump off a roof. I called one of our engineers and I was like, man, I got this. And he goes to me, wow, that's a weird one. I don't know what to tell you. So like the only thing, like my thought was like literally as soon as I'm getting on the plane, because I was going to simulate a higher suction by like basically throttling the suction ball valve for the whole loop. So if I loaded up that whole loop and got the pressure up to whereabouts the saturated need to be to raise those case temperatures up, theoretically, it would have saw that it was loaded up. It would have just had to sit there and throttle that medium temp a little bit, but essentially just me acting as the EPR. But
in that same rack, if you look at the CO2 side of it, it's the same thing. You're running like a plus or a minus 25 SST, and you got all these Hill Phoenix cases, the JV, like the whatever the model
JX,
number,
JX, it's got RNL like
30
like
letters in it. I can never find the
book for that.
But like those things will be way like below set point. They're super efficient cases. Don't get me wrong.
And they're good cases.
But they don't need to run a plus or a minus 25 or even a minus 20 set point to hit what they're hitting. If you look at them, like all the valves are open, like 2%, 3%, 5%. That's a huge issue. You need that mass flow on the CO2 side too. But that's why like floating the suction is key to these CO2 racks to make them run properly. Like everybody misses the boat with it. They, oh, you can't float. I have heard that so many times from OEMs. You can't float the suction on the CO2 because of the oil differential. Well, guess what? We can. You need like 50 to 60 pounds of oil differential and you need to be aggressive with the float. It's not a 1 PSI float interval like we're used to. Like, you need to be aggressive with it. It may be like 5 PSI. Because you got to remember, you're going up 5 PSI on CO2 is not much. So if you go from 400, let's say 394 pounds to 407. So that's a pretty good increase. That's almost, let's say it's 12 pounds. That's 2 degrees. Yeah. So you guys got to remember, like, I usually float a degree every 3 minutes. So I go quick float intervals, not 10-minute float intervals. I go 2 to 3 minute float intervals.
Yeah.
I want this rack if it needs to. If the cases aren't making temp, then okay, boom. Let's start throwing some more float at it. Start lowering the float. So let the float be aggressive. And the other thing with this is, okay, say you're doing some E2 stuff. Say you're in an Aldi and you got case controllers. All right, you have to make a standard circuit. You cannot float off an XM circuit. It will not let you. So you have to make a standard circuit and add a standard circuit in, and then
pull the data back from it. The data back from the discharge air and use that as basically your float.
Yeah.
Mother of God.
Yeah, it started to get loud in here. So you have to make a standard circuit to make your float. And then that way you can incorporate multiple cases.
Knock it off over there.
You just heard it through my mind.
Yeah, I know.
Dummy. So you can incorporate multiple cases into this by doing this. And you can make your own float circuit. Now, when I make my float circuits, I usually make it half a degree to a degree less than what the case set point is. So if I'm running a plus 28 case, like I'll usually make the float like plus 29.
Yeah.
So or I'll lower the case set point a little bit and then make that float the actual temperature. So that way that case controller kind of keeps rolling and doing its thing, and it's just there for a backup. And then I'll let the float circuit do its thing.
So essentially what you're saying is you'll have the set point of the case where it's doing the float lower, a little bit
higher.
Higher. So and then just the case set point is going to be there. So it'll never achieve that set point, right?
Correct. So say that in the case, say I'm trying to maintain a plus 28 degree discharge air in a meat case. I'll take that case controller, put it at plus 27. You're not going to freeze meat, whatever. And then I will put the float circuit at plus 28.
Yeah, so then basically what it's going to do is it theoretically wouldn't be able to maintain unless you had a hell of a pressure drop in that pipe. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then it's also gonna throw everything it can at this case to try to get it down to temp. It's not going to – you'd be like, okay, I'm close. I'm going to start closing down on the PID for the temperature. I want it to just throw the superheat at it and try to flood the coils down and be running off superheat, and then I want to be able to float that thing to maintain. I want the compressor – to drive that suction pressure in to try to maintain that case. And I want it to be more efficient like that. These racks transform themselves. You cannot fix the flash tank without fixing the suction.
That's the other thing I want to bring up. Like if you don't have if the VFD is too aggressive, the suction, at the rack is going to be straight. But if you don't have a solid stagnant suction, it will cause pressure increases on all your boxes and all your cases.
You know, and your lines too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So when I was in Arizona, I was looking at the pressure. I'm like, dude, my suction's straight. Like it suction's right where it needs to be. But I've got like a 25, 35, 45 pound differential. So until we got everything, kind of with the case controllers where we had to like tune it out a little bit, the suction for the rack was straight up. But because the cases still weren't tuned and they were undershooting and overshooting superheat consistently, essentially what would happen was it was causing a pressure drop in the pipe. So we temporarily, until we figured out what needed to be done with the cases to tune them out, we actually had to lower the suction just to get at least it down within whatever degree that we needed to before we could actually start getting that thing at suction pressure. And so once we got it, we pulled it down a little bit further, got the cases tuned where they were running. And I'm not talking like crazy down, but just enough that it's almost just about the SST that it needs to be. Then now it's controlling a better superheat and not going 0, 100 or 0, 75, whatever. Then we could put the suction back up, and then we didn't have that pressure drop in the pipe. And then we were only like, what, 5, maybe 10 pounds. And usually that's bad with any other refrigerant, but with CO2, fine.
Yeah, you got to remember 5, 10 pounds is only a degree, degree and a half. Okay, now here's the other caveat to this, guys. You will never, ever get efficient and tight superheat control when you have no EPRs and bad suction control. Because here's the thing. Until everybody starts speccing electronic EPRs in... That was weird. Until everybody starts speccing electronic EPRs and being able to control them off SST for every circuit, and we go back to what we were and letting the case controller control superheat, it's never going to be efficient. That's why these manufacturers are slapping these 10, 12 degree superheats in there, because, okay, you're trying to maintain superheat, a variable for that EEV. You're trying to maintain superheat. That's what that case controller does. Yeah. But when you start changing the variables, so instead of just looking at suction temperature and calculating superheat and doing that, now you're changing the suction pressure. So you're changing a second variable. So like you got this PID that's just chasing itself around in circles because you have another variable changing. It's not just the suction temp, the pressure's changing too. So it's they can't react and be good. You can't write a good algorithm when the variables are changing that much. That's why you need to slow these compressors down and get the suction more steady.
Give it time. Give the algorithm time to catch up, because if you're, like you're saying, if you're constantly just going up and down an anthill, that PID is like, oh, wait, it changed. Oh, shit, I don't know. Shit.
Yeah.
And it's just going back and forth, and it can't really figure out like where it has to be.
Correct. You could have the best PID control in the world, but if you have too many variables changing at the same time, it's going to be crap. So that's why the electronic EPRs, I think, is the fix to a lot of this, because getting those SSTs close and keeping those valves more steady reduces the line pressure, because it's going to keep everything steady and we're not hunting and loading up suction lines and unloading suction lines, loading up suction lines and unloading suction lines. And then it's going to allow the compressors to stop cycling so much.
That's another thing I want to bring up. So because you're giving a more steady superheat, because you don't have those changing variables, I've seen this firsthand. And I didn't think this had a lot to deal with it, but it does. Because so in some of these racks, right, you're using other variables in order to control certain things, right? So like LMP, Septec, there's a couple other manufacturers out there that use a heat exchanger in order to de-superheat your suction line if the refrigerant starts coming back rich. Okay, and usually what it's doing is it's using the line from the gas cooler. I didn't think this had a lot to do with it until I worked on that trainer. And so the thing was overshooting. The TR was like way too high. So it was going up and down and up and down. And you could see it was actually, because it's so precise and so like just a smaller unit where like small little changes affect it. Because that was going up and down so rapidly, it was actually affecting my suction of my compressor, because it was changing the capacity, because now your gas cooler is going, changing what's coming out of the actual gas cooler and essentially affecting the whole enthalpy of the charge. So if you're having that low superheat come back, now that heat exchanger is having to open up, now it's changing the parameters. So that's another one extra freaking thing that we're just throwing in there that, hey, we're going to change this shit too.
Yeah, that's a huge thing too. But like the low superheat, like coming back from the loops, it's usually like higher. We pick up the low superheat from the flash tank a lot of the times on the medium temp side. And that's an issue with the tuning also, because the flash tank is hunting all over the place because the suction is trash.
Not just that, you have all that shit just flying around, right? Yeah. So if the HPV is not tuned right, what we talked about last time, it's going to open up and then close up and then close up.
But here's the thing, like even if you tune out the HPV and you have trash suction control, the HPV is still going to be trash, because as compressors are coming on and off,
yeah,
that affects the HPV.
No, I agree.
That's going to change your drop leg pressure and your subcooling. It's all tied together.
Everything on these racks, on any freaking CO2 rack, everything affects everything.
That's why I start with getting the suction straight and then working on the flash tank, because if your suction's all over the place, your flash tank's all over the place.
So start with suction.
And then I move on to flash tank and gas cooler control.
Yep.
So that's why changing the mindset of how they're designing these suction groups and how they're controlling them has to happen for this to work properly. The other thing is like the low temp. So like we're talking about, we're running the high SST and the low temp. Okay. And we're shutting these cases off. Look at the superheat on some of these low temp compressors. Dude, it's like 60 degrees, 50 degrees.
Yeah.
Like the discharge lines, like it would be smoking hot if it wasn't running transcritical, or it wasn't running a booster, and it's going into the medium temp suction. You have a low compressor ratio.
Yes.
Okay. Make that compressor more efficient. Get that superheat down to like 35, 40 degrees.
That's what the manufacturer calls for, at 36. Yeah. And it's only because of the temperature of the oil, right?
Let's not overheat it, and let's make the cases more efficient. Let's get the efficiency that CO2 could actually have.
That's just going to slap the same settings on everything.
That's the thing. Like,
I know.
Like that CO2 could be so much more efficient than pull these DX racks out of the water 90% of the year, but they're held back by poor tuning and the way these are set up.
Yeah.
The other thing is like a lot of these VFD compressors are sized completely wrong. So
why do you say that?
I don't want the biggest compressor to be the VFD compressor. I see that all the time. I don't want that. These manufacturers want it to cover the biggest gambit. I would rather the VFD compressor be a smaller compressor and be able to cover the low end of the rack. Because here's the thing. I would rather, when it's high, yeah, I'd rather have the other compressors running and the VFD compressor moving. So I would rather have, say,
if you're going to say that, let's just go parallel suction.
What, parallel compression?
Yeah,
parallel compression. That's not worth it.
Nah.
It's not worth it unless you have a massive rack. I would rather have or two VFD compressors. Have one size. It increases the cost, but not really. A VFD is a shot in the bucket for what it's going to save you. Say you have a high ambient lead compressor and a low ambient lead compressor. Okay, you would only need it on the medium temp. Now, that would cover the gambit more, and it's gonna be a decrease for when that compressor starts up on an inrush current, and it's gonna be a soft start basically. So I would rather have two VFD lead compressors, but if it were me, I would choose the smaller compressor for the lead compressor every time, because when this thing's running at night and it's cold out and it's turned down, let's be honest here, like it needs to happen. And here's the other thing.
Any manufacturers out there want to build a Kevin rack? Yeah. Let's build a Kevin rack.
So here's the other thing. Night curtains. Like, this is a huge issue at Aldi.
Lame.
Like, they pull the night curtains down and the rack has zero load because you have two 25 horsepower compressors and the VFD at 50% cannot do it. It can't do it. Okay? It can't unload and load enough. So floating that suction up is key because you need to float that suction way up.
Yeah.
Okay? The dairy cooler's closed up all night. All the cases are shut down.
And even if you don't want to float it during the day, you essentially float it off of a time schedule. Hey, you know the load's going to drop off to nothing when they pull those strip curtains down at X.
You could raise that rack up. I've seen it. I've done it. I've played with it. I've raised those racks up. I've raised those racks up to a plus 26, plus 27 SST at night. Yeah. And the dairy cooler maintains fine, and all the cases start opening up more. You don't have a ton of load because the night curtains are down, but like, you definitely need that floating suction in order to keep that thing running and keep it from crashing. Now, yeah, a 15 horsepower compressor would be a lot better, and it would keep it, it would load up a lot better. Now, let's talk about the other part of this. So, we have the hot gas injection valves, okay. So we have those for Super Control.
Those are on what, the Advancers? I think Zero Zone has them too.
Zero Zone has them, the Advancers. These could also be used to help keep the rack running.
Low load. So now, not just high superheat, or I'm sorry, not just low superheat, but also like low load situation.
Hill Phoenix has a set, I think it's like 70 pounds, something like that.
Yes.
Raise them up. I raise them 15 pounds under suction pressure. Now, really? The reason I do this is I want to keep that thing loaded as much as I can. So now,
it's probably because if you don't have it tuned right, it's going to keep feeding intermittently.
Yes.
So you have to have the suction tuned first.
Yes.
Before you even try to do that.
Now, the ones I feel are way too small. I feel like the hot gas injection doesn't do anything.
Did I tell you I hate you lately?
We're having an honest conversation here.
All right. Yeah,
like, I think the DN2 valves are too small. I think the same thing with the oil.
If you're going to use it for a low load situation with the strip curtain.
Yeah, but even for the superheating, I think it's too small.
Okay.
I think it doesn't do a great job. Now, same thing with the oil valves. The DN2s are too small to me on the oil feeds.
Okay.
Zero Zone runs a way larger valve.
Yeah, you said you could basically wipe out the rack with that valve.
I mean, that valve will cycle. So if you take the valve that Zero Zone is using for their hot gas injection.
Yeah.
It will superheat. It'll add superheat to the rack, and it'll also keep a load up.
Which one's the DN2?
So a DN2 is that I forget what it manufactures. It's a high deck valve, but like it's an orifice valve. So it's a 2 millimeter, a 0.2 millimeter orifice valve.
Okay, I'm looking. So, oh yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. It's like a stainless steel solenoid.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think I found it. How about you could essentially do parallel?
You could do two of them.
Yeah,
and you could drill the orifice out.
Just saying. Then you could do like one for injection and one for
low load.
Yes, now, like both of them.
Here's the thing with this though. You can't rob Peter to pay Paul all the time.
Lame.
Because if you have super low load, then you're probably not going to have the discharge pressure to do it. But like, it may keep the rack running. I think the Hill racks need a slightly bigger valve than like the Zero Zone racks. Maybe like, they need to find a happy medium between the Zero Zone hot gas injection and the Hill Phoenix hot gas injection and meet in the middle there. And then you would have a decently sized valve.
CDS valve?
I don't think a CDS valve is the issue because now you're adding one more thing to tune. One more thing to tune on here. I do think that if we get that valve and we get it a little like a DN3 or DN5, I think that would be the answer to keep that in to keep it to where it's going to flow enough when we have low load that we could run the VFD unloaded, and we got that, and we're also keeping everything steady, and we also have enough super added to the rack when we hit these situations where we have a lot of flash gas load,
yeah,
and we're getting a little superheat. But that is the key, raising that set point up for what it is in the flexible combiner. It's way too low. You're not going to find it. Like, I've looked for, like, Hydex information is terrible.
I hate you again.
What? Like, they're
all right. Sorry, Hydex, if you're listening, which probably not, but like, if you're listening,
they make hydraulics. They don't care about us. they're not even in the market.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Like, why do we need to use the Hydex? Why can't we just use the Danfoss or Swinsborland electronic expansion valve? Those are ported valves.
Because they're on the discharge line.
Then let's just use it. Oh,
they need to be high pressure. Yeah. So that's why somebody needs to design a Sporland has that small.
Sporland has the high pressure valve, 130 bar.
I would think if you got a very small ported high pressure valve and did it with that and did it off of a PID loop, I think that would work fairly well. But the thing with it has to be controlling pressure and temperature at the same time, because you don't want to over superheat the loop. But that is why, like, the way that most of these manufacturers have these suction groups set up, they're just not set up, you know, properly to control. And then that's why floating suction has to come in. Everybody has to adopt floating suction. Yeah, it's been around on HFCs for forever, but they come around and act like it can't be done on CO2. It can 100% be done. It just has to be done properly. And then with that floating, that flash tank pressure, that is key there.
Yeah.
And then we talked about a little bit about the Carnot racks. Remember how they do their low temp. So they run a purposely low SST on the low temp to generate heat for defrost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know I was talking to them about this. So those racks, they run super inefficient when they're on the low temp because their valves are almost all the way closed, because the SST may be like a minus 30, and they only need like a minus 20.
Gotcha.
They're using that to generate heat. So you have a high suction return temp and you're generating a ton of heat. Okay. So run two set points in microthermal.
Yeah.
So you run a set point. So all your defrost are in a row. From 1 a.m. to 6 a.m., you're defrosting all these cases, okay? So when this is happening, you run a high superheat on set one. You run like a 10 to 12 degree superheat.
Okay.
Okay? When everything's not running defrost, you run a second set. And you run a low superheat at 6 degrees. So you could run two superheat set points, okay?
You're talking about the defrost now.
Yes. Okay. So if you need to make heat for defrost,
yeah.
Okay, you run a higher superheat.
We talked about this.
Yes, and that is the way to make those racks more efficient. You could save so much energy and make those racks run so much better by running two sets.
Yeah, it's not like you're not raising the head pressure, right? So you're not essentially wasting KW, right? All you're doing is just making that gas a little bit higher temp, sensible.
Yeah, you're making your sensible heat coming back to the compressor higher, which is going to increase your discharge temps, which is going to give you that heat for defrost.
Yeah.
That is a way to go about floating and then allowing you to float.
Yeah.
You could raise your SST up 10 degrees. A 10 degree raise in SST is a huge energy savings.
Yeah. I agree. I don't like the website. I don't like the website at all.
Yeah, it's bad.
I'm finding that out now while searching. So.
Yeah. So that's my thoughts on the floating suction, guys. And then we're going to parallel this with the next episode. We're going to jump into the gas coolers.
Yeah.
So.
Do we get a manufacturer on?
We should, maybe.
You get Gudner, BAC, SPX.
Get them all together in one group. And
Them cage fight. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Live from Chicago.
Yep.
Talk to you next time. Thanks.